The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello. In this week's podcast, we look at the long list for this year's Man Booker Prize and ask which were the novels that should not have missed out. And we talk to the Swedish historian Peter England about his blog's eye view of the First World War.
A cheerful lieutenant appears, his face red with exertion, and gives an order before disappearing off to the right. Rifle fire crackles in the distance. Manelli hears the groaning of a wounded man.
And just why did he call his book The Beauty and the Sorrow? Well, I'm afraid I have to fess up on behalf of the soothsayers of the Guardian Books Desk. Our predicted long list only had two books in common with the one that the Booker judges came up with on Tuesday, and they were the obvious ones, Julian Barnes and Alan Hollinghurst. With me to discuss the list is the critic Alex Clark, who happens to have reviewed three of the long-listed titles.
Not bad, eh?
That's very good for The Guardian. You've also been a Booker judge yourself, so I'm rather hoping you may give us some insights into the sort of particular agonies and ecstasies that went into this list.
I'll try.
Now, first of all, it's called The Booker Dozen. Why is it called The Booker Dozen when they're always 13 on it?
I think it's a little joke.
It's
a little attempt at humour to leaven this day of great decision-making that everyone looks forward to so eagerly. But there did used to be many more. Well, for a long time, we hadn't a clue what the long list was at all, did we? It wasn't announced, it wasn't published. Then when it was longer. And I think Man Booker sort of hit on this as a more sort of memorable way to do this.
Because actually prizes are often about the long list, aren't they? I mean, the winner's a bit of a lottery, but this gives you a pretty good reading list for the summer, doesn't it?
Yes, not bad, does it? And especially this year when we have to be truthful. There are lots and lots of things I haven't read on here. But yes, it's set us with plenty of homework for the next 2 or 3 weeks at least until, when does the shortlist come out? On the 6th of September.
So how relevant is the composition of the panel?
Well, Stella Remington is the chair, and you might expect, I suppose, to see some thrillers on the list, and there is a slightly kind of mystery and thrilling element to it.
And it's quite populist, isn't it, as far as we can see?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's kind of difficult until we really go into it and see, you know, exactly what all the books are like. But I think it has surprised people. There have been some omissions, and it does seem a less self-consciously literary list than one sometimes expects.
Now, just before we go into the list itself, one other thing is we always expect a bit of knockabout, don't we, from Booker judges? And we've had things happening like Saul Bellow making a pass at Antonia Fraser in the taxi back from a meeting. And we can say that now that he's no longer with us. Various sort of walkings out. It strikes me that we've entered the Twitter age rather dramatically with this. There's been a whole lot of stuff.
I know, it
going
all
on.
Went on, didn't it? In fact, I sort of got involved myself very briefly and crossly because everybody seemed to go on there the minute it was announced and start saying what had been left off, how they were disappointed, what they didn't like. And I thought, guys, could we just digest this for 5 minutes? Is it too much? But people were tetchy, weren't they?
Well, including Susan Hill, who's one of the judges.
And a great adopter of social media.
Yes, and who actually ticked me off for saying it seemed like an odd list. So Susan, if you're listening, I apologise for saying it's an odd list, and I will be taking all the ones I haven't read off on holiday with me. So let's just start now and actually not talk about the ones that haven't made it first. Let's talk about the ones that have. Number one is one of the ones that we did predict, which was A Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes.
I'm surprised you did from one point of view only, which is that, of course, it may not have passed muster with some panels. It's very, very short,
yes,
isn't it? It's 150 pages long,
yeah.
So could be called a novella. It's something rather delightfully, I can say, I've just started it. But, of course, that also means that I've nearly just finished it. Because it is so short, it is kind of wonderful so far. So it's really good to see that.
It would be lovely, in a sentimental sense, for him to win, because I always felt he should have won with Arthur and George in 2005.
Yes, that's right.
Robbed at the last minute.
Yes.
Okay, so another expected candidate is Sebastian Barry with On Canaan's Side.
He, with his previous novel, Secret Scripture, was on the shortlist in the year that I judged the prize.
And he won the Costa with it.
And then he won the Costa with it. And, well, for me, just a wonderful writer, just one of the most gifted, fascinating, endlessly inventive writers that we have. So I was thrilled to see him there.
Uh-huh. Now, the third one, Jamrach's Menagerie. I know it's pronounced Jamrach because Carol Birch, who's the author, came on this podcast and put me right on air. It's her 11th novel. And I know we both like this, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the ones on this list that if somebody came up to you now and said, I'm going on a holiday, I want to get to grips with this, what shall I take? You'd really pick this out, wouldn't you? Because it's a sort of rollicking ride of kind kind of adventure and suspense and high seas and cannibalism and the whole lot.
I have a confession to make, which is that I knocked it off our Booker proposed list at the last minute. And it was partly because it didn't get onto the shortlist of the Orange Prize. And it was partly because I didn't think it was a very Bookery book.
Did you think it was too enjoyable?
Yeah, I thought it was
too much fun.
Yeah, it's just an adventure, isn't it? And
it is. But although not just, I mean, there's something really sort of poignant. It's a very, because it's about these, you know, the two sailors going off to find, you know, all sorts of strange creatures in mystical lands. There's a bit of it that's really sad about male friendship and hero worship and all that sort of thing. It's got quite a lot of depth, more than just, you know, it's more than an adventure.
And
what
actually I found really impressive about it was the way that it takes you into the mindset of an 18th century sailor. So they go and pick up a Komodo dragon. They don't know they're Komodo dragons, and she just never says they are. It's just this horrifying lizard that they feel must have cursed the ship. And you know, you're instantly right back into the world of the Ancient Mariner, aren't you?
It's a lovely book, actually.
Okay, so we'll move on from there. There are three Canadian novels. What do we know about these? We've reviewed one of them, which was Half-Blood Blues, Essie Edugian, if that's the right pronunciation. This is one of actually five books. I'm coming over all statistical here. One of five books from the Independent Alliance, which we're very pleased about. It's Serpent's Tale. And this is a second novel, which begins in 1940. Very European. It's about a disappearance in wartime Berlin.
Yes, it's a historical novel, isn't it? Which, you know, and they are well represented on this list.
But also a Second World War novel, because also another of the Canadian novels is Far to Go, Alison Pick, which is also about the build-up to the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, debating the issues around kinder transport.
Well, we often have seen, you know, a lot of Canadian writers represented previously. I very rarely read a Canadian book that I don't enjoy.
There was a point.
But these are writers I just don't know.
There was a stage when they were all about logging, wasn't there? It seemed to me. But now we've moved on from logging. In fact, we've moved backward from logging to the Second World War and back to Europe, which I think is really interesting. It seems to me that there's a lot of taking stock of the wars of the 20th century on this list.
Yes,
maybe
that's quite right.
Moment of
quite
history.
Right.
Right, let's move on to one of the unknown ones for me is A Cupboard Full of Coats by Yvette Edwards, which is published by One World. And this is a writer who's a local to us, Alex, who lives in Hackney and has set her novel in the East End.
Exciting, isn't it? Just to have someone you really haven't heard of and from a publisher that I can't remember reading very much from before.
And we had to rely on her for her own summary because we couldn't seem to find any. And it's about filial guilt. So moving swiftly on, that's one of four debuts. Another one is Stephen Kelman's Pigeon English.
It's a tale of two debuts, isn't it, in terms of attention that they've had. I mean, this was a book that I read and reviewed as well, and I absolutely loved. I thought was really, really brilliant.
I had a problem with the pigeon. To explain the pigeon.
Well, I can't, because let's be truth, I love this book, but we all had a problem with the pigeon. There is a talking pigeon in it, and I'm not entirely sure why, and it was something that I didn't feel entirely worked, but I loved the book so much in all its other respects. It's about a little boy who arrives in this country from Ghana with his mother and sister, tries to get to grips with life on a council estate, and a London council estate. It sounds ever so grim, and it does indeed have some extremely...
It's got knife
sad
crime,
and disturbing
a lot of knife
and
crime
grim
in it,
elements and horrible violence in it. But it's a very, very funny book, and that sort of poignant comedy and the kind of exuberance of it made me forgive the pigeon.
Please leave the talking animals out. We've read rather a lot of them recently. Just don't make them talk. We're fine with animals. Now on to thrillers, which of course is where Stella Rimington comes in, or she probably doesn't actually, poor woman. It's probably Susan Hill who's actually really into
thrillers. Yeah, exactly. Thrillers. It can only be a matter of time. If we're just having instant tweet reaction from judges, surely we'll be allowed, cameras will be allowed into the judging room before too long, because it probably is unfair to blame Stella Rimington. She may write thrillers. There's no great evidence that she's a great proponent of them.
But also, there have been thrillers on before.
Yes.
In the year that you judged it, Tom Robb Smith's
Boy 44. That's right, it was on our long list. That's quite right.
Yeah, so it's not entirely out of the blue. And here we've got The Last 100 Days by Patrick McGuinness, who is actually a published poet, but has... It's quite interesting, this. He's gone back to his own experience teaching English in Romania and written a thriller of the brewing revolution there.
So, in fact, it's a kind of thriller plus, in other words, as Tom Robb Smith exactly was in that, you know, it was a Russian story. It's a thriller that brings you something else. It brings you news from somewhere else, which I think is what sometimes endears them to Booker judges.
And the other one is Snowdrops, which is by A.D. Miller. It was a Russian correspondent for The Economist.
Yes, that's right. And this is set in Moscow, and it's sort of about all sorts of gangsterish goings on.
Moving on to The Testament of Jesse Lamb, which is by Jane Rogers, another one we didn't know of, which sounds really up my street, actually. It's a dystopian novel. There are an awful lot of dystopian novels around at the moment, aren't there? And it's after an act of biological terrorism in this, and there are lots of women dying, and a 16-year-old girl sets out to investigate them.
And it's really very kind of new territory for Jane Rogers, isn't it? Who's been writing for many, many years, and she wrote things like Mr. Rose Virgins, for example, and is a wonderful writer, but has done something really, really different in this novel. I have read part of it, but not all of it, and I'm really looking forward to going back to it. I'm really delighted she's on there.
Then another familiar figure is DJ Taylor, who's on with Derby Day, which is a Victorian mystery, and I described him as a master pasticheur, which he probably would wince at. Is that fair?
He might do. My immediate thought when I saw him on this was he's sort of gamekeeper turned poacher, or poacher turned gamekeeper, or something. Yeah. He's just kind of eminent reviewer. Has been writing novels for many, many years and has written many of them, but now finds himself in this sort of, you know, people saying, what? Wow, DJ Taylor's on that list after so many novels. But yes, I think it's a Victorian mystery, isn't it? So, you know, we'll see what he does with that. I remember one of the books that I really enjoyed by him was about a football team in West London, so it couldn't be more different, really.
Well, this has got sport in it because it's set at the 1868 Derby. And finally, The Strangest Child. Alan Hollinghurst tipped to win by a lot of people, but not to all our commenters, actually. It doesn't have as much sex in it as we'd expect from a Hollinghurst novel, perhaps. It also has a female character at the heart of it for the first time. And when I read it, I was desperate to find out what other people thought of Daphne, the character at the heart of it. And you haven't read it yet. So
I haven't, no.
You won't be able to discuss it
with
me
either. It's my great summer treat. That's why. That's why I haven't read it. I've got it to one side to read on my holiday, because you have to savour every word with Hollinghurst, don't you?
Yes, absolutely.
You don't zip through.
No, I absolutely loved it, but some of our commentators weren't so impressed. And John Self Asylum, who to people who tweet will know is one of the best, predicted that if it got onto the long list, it wouldn't get any further based on the disappointment of all the people he talked to. So anyway, that's that for the list. And briefly, if we're going through the ones left off, are there any glaring omissions for you?
I was really sad not to see Adam Mars-Jones on there with his vast novel, Sadilla, which is the second part in possibly a four-part series. The first part was Pilcrow, and I just absolutely loved it. And I thought it's the kind of inventive, clever, imaginative, different, groundbreaking kind of fiction that I would just love to have seen there. Sad too for Linda Grant and for Philip Hensher.
It's interesting. I shed a little tear for Anne Enright. I really like.
Yes,
the
I really
Wells.
Like that book.
But I can see it's written in quite a minor key. Maybe that.
It's deceptively so, though, don't you think?
Well, that's what I felt. Mm. Now, just going through what our commenters thought. Spuzz99 said he would be very upset if River of Smoke by Amitav Ghosh wasn't on the long list.
Well, in fact, again, that is the second part of a big series of novels, and the first part was on the shortlist in my year.
And we actually put it off our book a dozen on that basis. We thought it was the second part.
You mean, really? And you don't think that counts?
Well, we had an argument about it, and I was won over by the forces of evil, let us say. Book Atlas and the James Hughes mourned the absence of City of Bohane by Kevin Barry.
Yes, I've heard very good things about it.
And the other people who got lots and lots of citations were Aravinda Diga for Last Man in Tower, Paul Bailey for Chapman's Odyssey, who got lots and lots and lots of supporters, Edward Hogan for Hunger Trace, Amitav Ghosh for River of Smoke, and Hisham Mattar for Anatomy of Disappearance.
And people have really talked a lot about Edward St. Aubyn as well,
and Edward
they?
St. Aubyn, yes. Mm. Well, there we go. It's a bit of a graveyard, isn't it? It can give birth, and it can also consign people to obscurity.
The problem is, you make a list in your head, and then the real list comes out, and everyone just cut you and is trying to tally your imagination and reality. I think it's exciting always.
I think it is. The last word, we have to give the last word to Paul Bowes, who pointed out that the commenters on our thread diverged as widely as we did from the actual list that the judges came up with. He said, the almost complete lack of unanimity at the long list stage suggests there is no real agreement, even among intelligent readers, as to which the best books in any given year might be. Yes, Paul, we know, but it is, as Alex said, all good fun. Now, we mentioned that Alan Hollinghurst is the bookie's favourite, and his book has another distinction too. It's a novel which spans the 20th century, but is predicated on the loss of a poet in the First World War. The First World War dominates our next item too, the forthcoming book by Peter England. The Beauty and the Sorrow draws from the diaries, journals and letters of 20 individuals and aims to convey how the war was experienced by the average man or woman. Richard Lee spoke to Peter England and asked him to read an extract from the book.
At that point, Monelli tells us, something fell away, and I no longer felt any anxiety. I am as controlled and clear-thinking as if I was exercising on the drill ground. Then, nothing. Patrols are sent out to scout around. Monelli and the rest of them keep watch, half asleep. Dawn breaks. A cheerful lieutenant appears, his face red with exertion, and gives an order before disappearing off to the right. Rifle fire crackles in the distance. Monelli hears the groaning of a wounded man. Then, nothing. The sun rises. They start to eat breakfast. Then, the sound of machine guns. The noise of battle grows, spreads, comes closer. A few men with light wounds pass them. Somewhere up in front, there is a battle going on. They stop eating. Some of the men swear. The platoon forms a line and sets off across the snow. Monelli wonders, is this death? This chaos of screams and whistles? These branches being clipped off the trees? This drawn-out wheezing of shells up above? Then nothing. Stillness. Silence.
I wanted to ask, why write about the First World War now, 100 years, almost 100 years after the death of Archduke Ferdinand?
Well, I think there are several motives to it. One is very simple if you are an academic historian, because the 20th century starts with the Great War, and it also sets the tone for the Great War. It's sort of ironic that the 20th century starts in Sarajevo and it ends in Sarajevo. It's the Germans have a good word for it. They call it the Urkatastrophe, you know, the starting disaster.
The original
disaster. Yeah. Yes, it's the same word as original sin. As an historian, you can answer it quite easily in that way.
It's simply the peak is there, the mountain is there to be climbed, so...
Yes, but there are also other interesting things to it. If you compare it to later conflicts, of course, the Second World War, there is a moral ambiguity to the First World War that you can't find in the Second World War. It's a much more simple story, the Second World War. It's a better narrative.
There's a bad guy.
Yeah, you have a bad guy, and you have the good ones and the bad ones. You have darkness and light, and it looks as if the, you know, darkness will prevail, but eventually, and you reach the, and throw down the ring into the volcano at Berlin, and everyone is happy. You have that moral ambiguity in the First World War.
Which makes it all the more interesting.
Yes, I think so. Eventually, it's a story about civilization self-destructing. You don't have that in the Second World War. That is about saving civilization. The bitter and ironic thing about the First World War is that all parties involved think they are fighting to save civilization. The Germans do, the British indeed do, the French and so on. And the end result is a sort of civilization disaster, civilization self-destructing.
So why did you choose to abandon that omnipotent God's eye historian's view, that traditional overview of the entire situation, to write an intimate history instead?
Again, I think there are several answers to it. One very simple one is that there have been written a number of very good books, for instance, Hugh Strachan and so on the First World War, using that type of narrative. So I saw absolutely no point in trying to do something that has already been done in an excellent way. But it's also a matter of simply trying on, almost as an experiment, another type of narrative. Can you build a sort of picture of the Great War without having the big picture, without having a grand narrative?
Is it modelled consciously on the internet experience, on the kind of blog reporting of reality that we're now living through?
Subconsciously, probably, because I have been an enthusiastic blogger. I'm an academic historian myself, but I have really taken to the blogging medium. But there is also something in the blogging medium that reaches back to earlier forms. One of the inspirations that got me working on the book, that was reading Robert Musil, you know, the Austrian author who writes Man Without Qualities. He has left a notebook and a diary from the First World War. And it is so bloggish, bloggy or something. It is composed just of simple short scenes, often no context, but he sees something and he catches it down in a number of, he dates it and I'm there and this is what I see.
And your experience of reading this kind of material, contemporary material on blogs, made you think this was possible in a kind of in a new form for history. The bits in between, the bits the waiting.
Yes, and which I find very interesting, also because I have been a war correspondent myself, and seen that when you go to a war, 95% of it is the waiting and standing around and listening to rumors and don't understanding what the hell is going on.
Like Morelli in the Alps and nothing happens.
Yeah, and nothing happens. It's everybody is tense and nothing happens.
So if you're not looking for the exciting bits, for the bits of color, how did you then go about selecting from this kind of mass of detail?
That's an interesting point, because obviously there is a huge amount of source material. But I wanted to choose people showing up the multiplicity of the experience. So there are women and children and men and soldiers and civilians and so on in a lot of different countries.
There's a whole kind of geographical sweep to it, which we're unfamiliar with the story of the Western Front.
Yes, I try to not stay away from the Western Front, but not getting dragged into it. It's so iconographic, the sort of, you know, the mud of Flanders and so on. It's almost turned into a cliché. First I chose the people, and then I started to distribute them evenly. I'm really talking about how I did it. I did a matrix.
There's a spreadsheet somewhere.
There is a spreadsheet, starting in August 1914, ending in November.
Is that an attempt to give a more realistic picture of what was going on in some sense?
Yes, I hope so. I think part of it comes from my experience as a war correspondent myself. I would never have written this book without that experience, especially if you're an academic historian and have written on war, and you come to war for the first times yourself. You get astonished by the sort of the gap of what you thought it was and what it was really like. So if it's something I wanted with this book, is trying to give you a sense of what it was like, and not least the mindset, what people are, how they are feeling, what they are thinking, the mindset of the Great War.
You call your book The Beauty and the Sorrow. I think that's even true in Swedish. It's Stridens skönhet och sorg.
That means the beauty and the sorrow of battle.
Yeah. having read these grisly accounts of these awful moments of unknowing and waiting, or these people struggling with hospitals full of people with limbs blasted off and flies surrounding them, I was wondering where the beauty was.
Well, the beauty is sort of catch-all phrase for what draws people into it, what makes war attractive for them, because that factor is still there. That I discovered, for instance, when I was in Iraq, because all the young soldiers I followed in Iraq, they were, of course, volunteers. And many of them, they really wanted to go to war, and it's still so. There is an attraction to it. There is something that pulls people in. Of course, the tragedy of the Great War is that so many people get pulled in. Now it's a sort of a minority position that, hey, war seems to be great fun, I want to have a try. But then 1914, it's a sort of, we call it a mass psychosis now, and I think that's the wrong way to look at it. The beauty is all those factors that mesmerizes people. And there is a passage from this Cushing, the American surgeon, and he is literally standing up to his elbows in brains and blood all the day, because his main specialty is brain damage. And eventually, modern neurology starts with him, and partly starts in Passchendaele, because there he gets so many of these brain damages.
But he can see what doesn't work.
He stands with his arm up to his elbows in brain and blood all day, and eventually one day he gets to go up to Zillebeke and see the Canadian build-up, because they are doing another push, some, well, 100 meters or something. And he knows what the cost of the war is to individuals, and he gets mesmerized. And I have a full quote of him, and he says that the barbarian in you awakens when you see this. And you understand that this is what men are made for. And this is a very civilized man. It's very easy to identify with him. This is a very civilized, high educated, with none of this jingoism at all. But he looks into the abyss and the abyss looks into him, to quote Nietzsche. That's what the beauty refers to. And of course, then it's another thing, aesthetically speaking, especially if you are a bit away,
war, especially at night, can be quite beautiful, with tracer going out and going in and explosions and so on. If you're not in the thick of it, it can look pretty.
In a kind of awful way, yes.
Yes.
Having got your hands dirty, as it were, with this kind of novelistic, intimate, blog's eye view,
yes,
can you imagine going back to the historian's traditional omnipotent perspective?
Well, I think I will have a problem with it, but I think I will eventually do, because I think there is a general need for that mode of narrative.
That clarity.
Yes, the clarity of it, because I really don't want to say that this is the way that history should be done, because that would be a sort of disaster in its way, because we need the big picture, the trash.
The journalist as well as the bloggers.
Exactly. So this is, as I said, this is an experiment. I will probably not, I think the other way is around is true, I will probably not return to this mode of narrative again. You can only do it once. I will, as an historian, will probably return to and finish my trilogy on the 17th century and do it the traditional way.
Peter England talking to Richard Lee. The Beauty and the Sorrow is out in the autumn from Profile, but you can pre-order copies now. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be previewing the Edinburgh Festival and interviewing some of the novelists who'll be there. But for now, thanks to Peter England, Alex Clark, Richard Lee, and our producer, Ian Chambers. I'm Claire Armistead. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.